practice of Zen, many of you may have heard some of these things from many times, but I would invite you to have it new each time. For it's not so much getting ideas, but it's putting these things into practice so that we become free. And Zen is really about becoming free, if you want to put any simple words on it. And that invites the question about free from what or free to do what. And if we focus on free from what, it's freedom from being a slave, being a victim. And it is the very thing that is so characteristic of us human beings that is also, and might say the instrument of our success on the planet, that is the very thing that is the avenue to slavery and victimhood for us beings. So I want to talk about a couple of those things tonight and to point out that Zen is primarily about how. It's not what, because we can't express that which is the only one reality by any words, because in order to attempt to do such a thing with words, one would have to stand outside of it, and there's no place to stand outside of it. There is only one reality. And immediately the mind will rush in and try to make an idea of that, and what one has to realize is that that is part of the old habit of our minds. And it's a very wonderful thing, as we always say, that this mind generalizes and uses certain techniques that have been analyzed for this process of building models and representations in the mind of what they call reality on the outside. They generalize, they select or delete, and they distort in order to form a model or representation within the mind. The problem is human beings think this is actually equal to the thing that they are attempting to represent. Any ideas we have of a tree of another person is not that other person, nor a tree, and especially of ourselves. Any idea that we have of ourselves is not who we are. We have to do a lot of skullduggery in order to hold on to the idea that it really is who we are. And a simple way to pull the rug out from under is, whatever you think you are, is that what breathes you, and is that what pumps your blood? And is that the source of all your words and so on? If a person's being honest to things, one realizes that whatever the conception is of oneself, it does not fulfill those criteria. So, the avenue to finding who and what we are, that is to say, to come into the knowledge of the one reality of which we are. It's not even a part. We are that one reality. We're not a part of it. We're not a subset of it. We are that one reality ourselves. And that, to the mind used to generalizing and making ideas, is absolute and total nonsense. So there's a lot of work involved in the practice of Zen that is turning upside down a lot of the things that have been taken for common sense and which, even more so, are profoundly useful in the world. But there's one area for which these methods of generalization and making internal representations and so on that is not useful, and that is knowing what we are. Knowing this reality beyond all words. And once you look into the matter, it becomes clear that that's something that ought to at least be one of the principal works of a human being, if not the main principal work. For it is the only place that we are relieved from suffering, for all of suffering is based upon living in a dualistic world and having all kinds of conceptions of things that have no substance. So, practice of Zen is becoming free from slavery to these processes that are very useful, but that cannot provide us with any ultimate knowing of who and what we are. So one of these things is making things very special. Now, there's nothing wrong with making things special. The problem is to become a slave to doing that. As though there is some specialness in anything in the world. For everything in the world has a unique quality. In that sense, it's special. It's important, but you must examine clearly what you mean by important. Important by what criteria? And for what purpose? And with respect to what? And you find out that things are important only with respect to some particular goal or some particular idea or framework or source of meaning or whatever it is in our being, and they are not intrinsically important. So a grain of sand is no more intrinsically important than the Constitution of the United States. For we apply these importances based upon our criteria for various purposes of having a humane society where people have the liberty to pursue their uniqueness or whatever it may be, or to build a building or whatever. With respect to a particular goal or aim that we may have, various things become important and various other things become unimportant. But it's very important to realize that none of these things are intrinsically important. That is not to say they are unimportant. It is that they are neither unimportant nor important. I remember when I was doing a pilgrimage in India back in 1978, that I really came across, I came across early on, because I landed in Delhi, and went to Agra, which is near Delhi, and I was struck with what I thought at that time was the most beautiful building that I had ever seen or could conceive of. And that was, of course, the Taj Mahal. And it, I just stood and admired it and just saw that it matched a lot of criteria that I had for beauty. Its harmony, its all kinds of things. In addition to the marvel of human beings that could envision it and could construct such a an edifice. And the marvel of the human mind and all that sort of thing. But as I continued through India, there were many marvelous things. And finally, that included just a coconut that had fallen on the ground, or the way the waves lapped up against the shore in the Bay of Bengal. And finally, it really became more and more profoundly apparent to me that they were all very worthy of the kind of attention that we are invited to put on something which we label important. And when we put that level of attentiveness on things, we realize something about their intrinsic nature, their intrinsic uniqueness, their intrinsic cherishable quality. And so early on in the 12th century, in China, a person, Su Tong Po, wrote these famous lines. Mount Lu in misty rain, the river Che at high tide. How I longed for such a long time to see them. Finally, I was able to go and see them. Mount Lu in misty rain, the river Che at high tide. Just this. Nothing special. Now, what was realized by this person in going to visit these famous sites was not that they were not worthy of attention. It's not that they were not magnificent, that the reputation that they had gained for their beauty their awe-inspiring quality, whatever it was wrong. It was just that what was more evident to him was that they are what they were, just the River Che at high tide, Mount Lu in misty rain. And as you learn to not be addicted to spending life trying to find the special and important and wondrous things, then you create the conditions within your being for the world to open up and reveal its magnificent uniqueness every place. And this is a very important lesson. It is one way in which we get to be released from something that keeps us in bondage. For folks are in bondage as long as they think that. For example, there's a book out that it's called The 1,000 Places You Must See Before You Die. Well, that could create a nice kind of entertaining and time-consuming use of one's life, and I'm sure it would be very pleasant and pleasurable. There might be a certain amount of anxiety to get up to 132 of them, and you start to get infirm, and you know that you're not going to do the whole 1,000. Maybe you haven't done the really important, beautiful ones of the 1,000, and so you really are missing out, and so on. I don't need to go on about that. That's how people are. They do comparisons, and they create conditions for the satisfying life, for the life well lived. And that, of course, is setting themselves up for a great amount of suffering. It never turns out the way you envision. And so one is driven, as one explores that in oneself, to drop away the conditioned situation, that one's life is conditional to having accomplished or seen or heard or experienced this and that, and move towards the unconditioned life that is always present. Mount Lu and misty rain and the River Che at high tide is present in every step that one takes, every little blade of grass that one can see, every little ant walking across the pavement, if one has the eyes to be in this present moment, the only life one has. So that's a very important thing. So the very thing that produces a structure for one's life, and that is very useful in certain contexts, that is making things important so that you can accomplish certain goals and so on, is the very thing which, if it's done rampantly and allowed to take over one's whole being, is one of the instruments for our enslavement. And it's very important to be able to pick up that ability to make things important, make them match the criteria that are important for the accomplishment of any particular goal or task or whatever, and then to be able to put them down and to realize that one's life is not conditioned by being able to fulfill all these things, but rather is much more important to realize that one's life is unconditional. It would be silly for someone to approach a newborn baby and say, well, you know, we'll take care of you and give you love as long as we can get the assurance that you'll go to Harvard and that you'll win a Nobel Prize and that you'll see all the important things of the world or whatever. It's silliness that one might invest in this poor young child. Obviously, we do not do that. Some may, I don't know, but one can easily see through the silliness of that, because the little baby's life is unconditionally valuable just as she or he is. We forget that as time goes on, because we're in a culture that is highly conditional. And makes commerce in certain ideas of what life is all about, what the significance of life is, an accumulation of possessions or accomplishments or prestige or places in the hierarchies of the world or whatever it may be. So this is part of the liberation, part of the coming into freedom, part of the letting go that allows one to be. And paradoxically, it allows one to pick up the criteria and accomplish things and do whatever else that is one's karmic bent, but without the addiction that one's life is dependent upon. And that's a very important difference. So the second example I'd like to just talk about is another person. This is about one person by the name of Yang Shan, another Chinese back in the Tang or Song dynasty. So he says that for every word that his master had to say, Yang Shan was said to have 10. Finally, his master said to him, "Someday you will meet someone who will fix you." Years later, Yang Shan went to study under Master Kui Shan, famous Zen master of the Tang dynasty, who said to him, I have heard that when you studied under your first master, you spoke 10 words to his one. Is that true?" Yang Shan replied, "Well, that's what people say." Kui Shan asked him, "What do you have to say about the real meaning of Buddhism?" And as Yang Shan took a deep breath to answer, Kui Shan shouted a silencing, "Ho!" 3 times Kui Shan put the question. 3 times Yang Shan attempted to reply. And 3 times he was silent with a peremptory, "Ha!" Finally, with tears in his eyes, Yang Shan hung his head. "My late master foretold that I would learn better with someone else, and today I have met him." So, we alluded earlier to this wonderful capacity that we human beings have to articulate and to do what we call communication. Strange meaning of communication has right hidden within the meaning to come into unification. In other words, to come to be on the same wavelength, we say, as another person. And at a deeper level is to communicate one's idea or conception or reality that one experiences in such a way that it can be experienced also by the other. Now that occurs very rarely. We put up with a communication which, in our little joking way, we say is good enough for government work. In other words, it may not really transmit the level of our experience to another person so that they too can step into it and know it. But it's, we say, good enough. And if you listen to what passes for communication, you see that there's a lot of assumptions that people have, that they basically have the same dictionary as somebody else. And when someone says, for example, I was really disappointed by what happened today at work. And a person will often say, "Well, I know what you mean." And they haven't the foggiest clue of what they mean, because they don't have any tools to mine that black box that is inside, from which that statement came that they were disappointed in what happened today. This is an abbreviation. This is what Chomsky calls surface structure, as opposed to the deep structure, a way in one's being that contains the all the associations around each word, that gives for each individual a different connotation for every word in the surface structure or every gesture. And we delude ourselves to think that we really understand another person by this assumption that we have the same meanings of all these terms and words within ourselves that they have. And that's a common assumption. So that's one level of this slavery. We are kept in isolation from other people by the inability to develop appropriate tools or methods in order to truly enter into the experience of another. But speaking only of ourselves with respect to the world, the use of words is rarely understood that when we use words, for example, the precept against lying that we study in Buddhism, the bodhisattvic precept against lying, Bodhidharma's verse to this precept points out that we just have to open our mouth and say anything, and we have lied. Which points to this profound fact, the realization of which and the practice of that realization can lead to another phase of liberation. And that is that every word, of course, has a definition, does it not? Wouldn't be a word, wouldn't be useful for us if it didn't have a definition. If one set of sounds meant anything you wanted to, the way I think Alice in Wonderland, somebody in that said, and maybe I'm wrong, but there's something in there that has whatever meaning I apply to it, somebody in that. Somebody back there in one of those stories said that. It would be of no use to us. It might be a fun thing to do, but words are, when we use them in communication, we depend on that we have some understanding of what their definition is. However, apart from what I just talked about the improbability of true good communication to really understand what another person is talking about, words themselves break up this one reality. And that is why just opening our mouth and saying any word is a lie with respect to this fundamental reality. And Bodhidharma's verse to that precept begins with the line, self-nature is clear and obvious. But it is to make this self-nature, this fundamental nature of our being, clear and obvious, that is part of the function of the practice of Zen. And we have to realize that words stop us from that. Although, just as in the previous example that I gave of being able to make visions and representations inside of the world so that we can achieve certain goals, so likewise, words are essential and very useful in the commerce of daily life. But again, once again, for this purpose of really knowing who and what we are, they are not only useless, they are profoundly inhibitory. And so therefore, the logic of silence in our practice of Zen. And it's a much more profound silence. It's not a silence to not interrupt people. Not a silence because silence is somehow better, more kosher or something than talking or noise making or whatever it is. But it is a way that we hurt ourselves if our intention is to come to know what and who we fundamentally are. For when we try to put this into words, then we are immediately, as we say, turning south in the attempt to find the North Star. So, this man Yang, beating Kuishan, was given a real gift at beginning to learn to quieten his mind, to not rely on, he was probably very facile with the use of words, But he made the profound misunderstanding that this matter can be accessed through words. It is rather to be accessed through silence. And how do you do silence? Well, likewise, how do you stop relying upon representations in the mind that, for folks undertaking the practice of Zen or any spiritual path, the danger is to envision what enlightenment is, or to envision what progress is, or to envision what a silent mind would be like, and then trying to match it. And again, the person has to realize that they have divided their being. Therefore, they have once again started looking south to find the North Star. So how do you do it? Well, the unconscious mind cannot process not. So you can't say, don't pay attention to the internal representations. Don't talk to yourself. It doesn't work, because you have to erect the idea of talking to yourself in order to check whether you're doing it or not. And so you're putting yourself in a bind. And likewise for internal representations. So what do you have to do? You have to learn the art of disregarding whatever comes into your conscious mind. And that requires another kind of understanding of our being. As I sometimes use the analogy that whatever comes into your mind is none of your business, I tell people. And that it's very much like junk mail. It happens to come into your mailbox. But it really doesn't really have anything to do with you. You didn't invite it, nor did anybody spend a lot of time figuring out what you would really like to receive in order to further your life, and thus send it to you. We all know how these things happen. So just because it comes into your consciousness as a result of causes and conditions, the coming together of internal factors and external stimuli and goodness knows what else, we are incapable of knowing all the causal conditions that give rise to anything that comes into the mind. But it just comes in and it has its life, or it sticks to us, or we stick to it, whatever you think might be the appropriate way of saying it, and we elaborate on it, or we entertain ourselves with it, or we do whatever else with it, but you all know that it has no lasting residue if it was uninvited. If you invite it in order to think about something with respect to a project that's important in your karma, that's a very different thing. We're talking about the uninvited things, which creates the bulk of these internal denizens of consciousness. And these leave no beneficial residue. They are, for that reason, none of your business. And so to cultivate the idea that these are just like the sounds of cars on the street as we sit here tonight. And if people were walking along the pavement outside, the sound of their voices as they come and get louder, and as they walk away, they get fainter. And it's of none of our business. We didn't invite it. It is not about us, not about anything that's relevant to us. It's none of our business. And to learn to treat the ordinary daily content of our field of consciousness the way we would treat those things is a very important piece of the art of practicing Zen. Because what it does is it allows the mind to come to rest, to come to peace, to come to a place where we no longer rely upon, another way to put it is we are no longer the slaves of this process in mind of having to figure out everything. And look at everything, and name everything, and put meaning on everything, and take action about everything. It's not necessary. We can just let things be. And that's a positive way of putting it, and does not require that the unconscious mind deal with its knots, N-O-T. So it's really unproductive to say, I shouldn't do this, I will not do that, but rather to say what thing to do is simply to ignore. And the ignoring has to be founded upon the true understanding that these things were not invited, and they truly are none of our business. Because they were not invited, because they are not of value with respect to some particular function that we have in the world. Now, the practice of Zen treats everything. To learn the art, you have to treat everything that way for a while. You have to do that because what's the alternative? The alternative is to distinguish what's important enough to let go and what's important enough to hold on to. And this, of course, sets you up again for a duality, and you're going down the same rabbit hole. So it's really important to, when one is practicing Zazen, to learn to treat everything that comes into the mind in that way. Physical sensations, emotions, thoughts, memories, fantasies of the future, great insights, explanations of things that you've wondered about for a long time, and all those sorts of things, just let them be. Let them be. Let them float in and float out, and you couldn't care less. The attitude is, come in if you want, go out if you want, but you're of no relevance to me. And when one does that from a place of real understanding and not condemnation and not pushing away or not making a judgment upon these thoughts, but simply realizing how they obstruct one and how they really function to put one into a narrowing down of mind and a slavery, then it becomes easier and easier to let them be. Now, the end result of this is what happens when you practice both of these things with respect to internal representations and with respect to the use of words and all that that entails, comparisons and all the rest of it. When you let them all be, what happens is a true silence of mind develops, which means operationally a true ending of the clutter in the mind that acts as a mist, as an obstruction. For what is always here, what stands before our eyes and ears and senses all the time, for everything that we see or hear or touch is a manifestation of this that we call the one reality, the body of Buddha, we might say the fundamental nature, our true nature, any of those words all point to the same thing. And that was the great revelation that the Buddha brought to the world. And it is very clearly, when you look at it, the true ending of suffering. For suffering is based upon duality, yes, but what aspect of duality? The aspect of comparing. It ain't good enough, it ain't right, it ain't the way I want it to be, and so on and so on. And we thus generate for ourselves suffering. Suffering does not exist in the sensory world. Pain exists, you step on a tack, but suffering does not exist. We create suffering, and this is the mechanism for the creation of suffering. And so, if however we do this practice in order to end suffering, we're setting ourselves up again, because we monitor whether suffering is decreasing. And this is all just a nonsensical thing. We are putting an obstruction in our way again. So, that leads to the fact that in Zen we have to practice without adherence to a standard or a goal. We simply do the practice without thought of time, without thought of gain, without thought of getting rid of anything or gaining anything, without any consideration for whether a self is becoming bettered or improved or anything. And of course, the great paradox is that as a result of practicing in that way, we get to accord with this one reality. The way it's put and sometimes in Buddhism is that we come into conformity with the Dharmakaya. And then we create the situation in ourselves. Not that we need to practice in order to create this condition, for it, that will not work out for the same obvious reasons that I've been emphasizing. but rather it is created automatically. That we create a space where anything can awaken us to this fundamental reality. And I mean anything. It could be a splash of water in the face. It could be a taste. It could be a bumping your arm into something. It could be the sound of something. It could be anything, really. Because when the mind is pure, that is to say, it has nothing in it at all, it is just this one. We cannot put words on it. What are we to say? One great space? No, because every word we put on it invites a comparison. Oh, I want to get to that place. I wonder if I'm getting there yet. You have to see the fallacy of all of that. And therefore, we have the three pillars of Zen. The classic three pillars of Zen. That everything has to be put into doubt, which means you go, well, yeah, but, you know, that's not really what it is, so I'll just let it be. And the second one is to have trust. So you do this practice with the trust that all the people that have proposed that one do this practice in order to come to realization were not either crazy or stupid. That it actually is efficacious for this process. And so you trust. And you realize that you can't put a timeline on it. You can't say, well, I'll do this for 3 months and we'll see what happens. It has to be a way of life. And when you do that, you're practicing without time and you've learned the other three pillar of Zen, which is determination and persistence. And if one realizes that to attempt any other means to come to know who and what we are is fraught with such paradoxes that it leads inevitably away from what it is that the Buddha taught was our inherent nature, because it plunges us into duality. And so finally we realize there is really only one way to do this. There's only really one work. And the acceptance of that and the practice of it is to bring the practice of Zen into our daily life. As Zen Master Hakuin used to refer to it as the continual spirit of Zazen. Which is a wonderful way to think about it. It's not the right path, but it's the spirit of it. The noticing with some kind humor the way the mind operates. And just letting be all those old attachments and all that sort of thing. And trusting that as one does that and becomes more and more accustomed to that style, that one day awakening will occur. And this is the practice of Zen. So we'll end there today.